When we look at the question of good, could God be using the Muslim terrorism of today and the persecution we are receiving from Muslims and others to discipline his church, to wake his church up, to alert us? Yes, of course. God has used the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Egyptians in the past in order to oppress his people as a discipline for their disobedience and as a consequence of their foolishness and of the breaking of God's commands. But that is not to say we should not resist. We should be fighting against Islam. We should be learning the lessons. Islam is strong today because the church is weak. And when the church was strong, Islam was behaving itself much better. But at the moment, we're full of compromise. But not only that, the church is full of pacifism. Where many Christians think it is clever to be stupid, it's clever to be unintellectual, they think it is spiritual to be anti-intellectual. You get a lot of Christians have this idiocy of rejecting knowledge and think that running around like these American televangelists screaming and making scenes and screaming at God and demanding and making idiots of themselves on TV, they think that is clever. Of course, many people look at this with contempt and think this is foolish. And it is. None of the prophets behaved like that. None of the apostles behaved like that. And the frauds and the corruption of so many of the televangelists, these false prophets on the TV who get so much support, this has lowered people's respect for the church. When it looks like money-grabbing false prophets who are filling their coffers and living like kings off the offerings of poor people, of course, this is a disgrace. And then there are Christians who are pacifists. Well, the Muslims can attack our churches because in many cases our people are not ready or willing to defend themselves. And there's nothing the Muslims respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. And so when we act weak and stupid, we encourage the Muslims to attack us. It's like a bully loves fear. When he sees someone who's afraid, the bully is fueled, they're energized. And in the same way, you can see the criminals look for the weak, like the hyena preys on the weak member of the herd, the one who's straggling behind and is weak. That's who the hyenas go for. And so in many cases, when the church acts weakly and foolishly, then we invite this kind of mistreatment by the Muslims. We need to be strong, submit to God, resist the devil, he will flee from us. Greater is him who is in us than him who is in the world. We are more than conquerors through Christ Jesus who strengthens us. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Now, when we have this kind of Christian spirit, then the enemy will flee from us. But when we act foolish, and when we are acting like these false prophets on TV, well, the Muslims have contempt. And then they feel justified in attacking. And when we don't even defend our families or our churches, well, of course they have contempt for us. The Bible says, 1 Timothy 5:8, if any man does not make provision for the members of his own household, he is denied the faith and he is worse than an infidel. And there are many Christians who think they should not fight or defend. Every one of God's creatures will fight to defend their young. But some born-again, Bible-believing, blood-washed, spirit-filled, tongue-speaking Christians will not defend their family. They think it's spiritual to stand and pray in tongues while a wife's being raped. I've heard these kind of stupid testimonies from people who are worse than infidel. Every animal will fight to defend its young. God has given all his creatures weapons, either flight or fight. They have horns, hooves, teeth, talons, claws. Some of poison and fangs. The thing is, every one of God's creatures has been given a weapon, or even several weapons to defend themselves. And yet there are Christians who think that we are the only part of God's creation that's meant to be defenseless and not resist when others attack. But Nehemiah 4:14 says, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your wives, your sisters, your mothers, your homes. And so we as Christians need to get that martial spirit again, that crusader spirit, the spirit of those who would stand up and fight against evil. Because right now our churches are weak and wimpy, and that is why 1,000 churches have been attacked and destroyed in Nigeria in 5 years. 16,000 Christians murdered by the Muslims. If you've got a football field, but only one team on the field, you can score a lot of goals. And at the moment, the Muslims have the football field to themselves, because we haven't put a team on the field. They're just kicking balls into our goal over and over, because we're not opposing them. And we need to learn from the past, which is why this morning the first session will be about understanding the Crusades, because it's a very misunderstood area of church history. And Christians are apologizing for the Crusades, even while the Muslims are attacking our churches in the name of jihad. Understanding the Crusades. The Crusades were a reaction to Islamic jihad. Muslim armies had conquered most of the Byzantine Empire. The enemy was literally at the gates of the greatest Christian city in the world at that time, Constantinople. Muslims had conquered Spain, what they called Cordoba, Sicily. They had conquered southern Italy and many of the islands in the Mediterranean Sea. Vast territories that had once belonged to Christians are now under the rule of Islamic rulers who abused the Christians, looted the churches, kidnapped, tortured, and ransomed Christian pilgrims. Millions of Christians were being enslaved by the Muslim world. Muslim pirates were threatening Christian shipping, kidnapping people on the high seas. Christian lands were threatened by Islamic raids and full-scale invasion. Even before the death of Muhammad in 632 AD, Muslim forces were already raiding the Byzantine Empire, the old Eastern Roman Empire, and Persia. Both Byzantium and Persia were weakened by incessant wars against one another. And that's one thing that enabled the Muslims to get the upper hand, was because the Christians were busy fighting one another. Persia and Byzantium fighting one another, much like how Christians in the 20th century fought one another in the First and Second World War and caused astounding devastation and enabled Islam and communism to rise because of the foolishness of Christians wasting energy in fighting one another. Lots of lessons for our personal and denominational lives right there. The Arabs were able to exploit the exhaustion of the Persians and the Byzantines, not only by hit-and-run raids for plunder and loot, but also by sustained military campaigns to steal substantial territory away from these vast empires. Syria was the first Arab conquest. At that time, Syria was a province of the Byzantine Empire. It's a Christian country. The capital of Syria, Damascus, was the oldest continually inhabited city in the world. The land of Syria was far more fertile than the land of Arabia. And after centuries of Byzantine rule, Syria had fallen to the Persians in 611. And it was retaken by the Byzantines in 630. And as the Persians had destroyed the institutions of Byzantine rule, a leadership vacuum had developed. As the Byzantine Empire employed many Arab mercenaries to guard against raiding other Arabs from the south, the defection of most of the Arab defenders left huge gaping holes in the defense of Syria. And you can see today how foolish America is to have so many Muslims in the army and to have so many Muslim allies, which is only going to undermine everything they do. And many American soldiers find themselves being murdered by the Arab allies, and even by Arab officers in the American army. At Fort Hood, you've had cases of Arabs in the American army murdering Christians who are disarmed on the base. This has happened before. People should learn from history. During key battles, the defection of Arab mercenaries who were meant to be fighting for Byzantine was decisive in turning the tide of the battle against the Christians. If people think Muslim mercenaries will be faithful when they're fighting other Muslims, they're foolish. When it comes down to it, Muslims will side with Muslims. That is to them more important than any national patriotism. Soon the Muslim Caliph established Damascus as the capital of the growing Muslim empire. So they moved now from Mecca to Damascus as their main capital. The next target was Persia, which at that time included Mesopotamia, what today is known as Iraq. Here as well, whole units of Persian cavalry consisted almost exclusively of Arab mercenaries. And the Muslims managed to exploit this conflict of loyalties by persuading whole units of Arab mercenaries to turn traitor and to join the Muslim side. Soon even the heartland of Persia, what is known as Iran, was conquered by the Muslims. Yet the Persians continued to rebel against Muslim rule for at least another century. Persia is one of the few places in the Middle East where they kept their language. All the other places lost their language and got absorbed in speaking Arabic. Just Turkey and Persia kept their language of all the countries in the Middle East. Caliph al-Mansur moved the capital of the Muslim empire from Damascus now to Baghdad, capital of Iraq. From this base, the Muslim armies moved out to conquer the Indus Valley of India, what today is Pakistan. As Palestine was part of the Byzantine province of Syria, the decisive defeat of the Greek forces at the Battle of Yarmouk left Jerusalem vulnerable to attack. Many Jews, hostile to the Greek Christians of the Byzantine Empire, welcomed the invading Muslim armies and opened the gates of Jerusalem to the Caliph in 638. But despite this treachery, the Caliph prohibited all Jews from living in Jerusalem, so it didn't help them to betray their Christian neighbors. Egypt was a province of the Byzantine Empire. The abandonment of Syria and Palestine by the Greek forces left Egypt particularly vulnerable and isolated. The first invasion of Egypt in 639 by the force of Caliph Umar was unsuccessful. In 640, a force of 12,000 Muslims attacked and succeeded in luring the Byzantine Empire army out of their secured walled cities, where they were ambushed and slaughtered in great numbers. Foolish when you've got such great defensive features as walled cities to come out and give up your advantage. The Muslim invaders then massacred the inhabitants of the undefended towns, Nicaea and a number of other towns. Alexandria was the second largest city in the Christian world after Constantinople at that time. And the Arabs now attacked the city of Alexandria, but they were repulsed, thrown back with great losses. And the Arabs then went out of range of the catapults and the arrows of the wall and began what should have been a hopeless siege. As Alexandria was a port city, the Byzantine navy had supremacy of the Mediterranean Sea, so they could easily resupply and reinforce Alexandria for as long as was necessary, so the Arabs had no chance to win this siege. However, inexplicably, the governor of Egypt, Cyrus, betrayed Alexandria and all of Egypt by handing it over without a fight to the Muslim invaders. This is how the Muslims have advanced greatly, by treachery. 4 years later, Byzantine fleet of 300 naval ships arrived at Alexandria and reconquered the city of Alexandria once again with ease. So the Greeks again had an impregnable position behind formidable walls of the city. However, a foolish and arrogant commander led his soldiers out in a very ill-advised move, a move that made no military sense, and he was ambushed. But even so, the Arabs still had no chance of conquering Alexandria. It was at this time that a traitor opened the gates of the city to the Arabs, and the Muslims poured into the city, massacring, plundering, burning, until more than half of the great city of Alexandria was destroyed, including the greatest library in the world at that time with 6 million scrolls and manuscripts. Recognizing their great naval weakness, the Muslims now turned to Egyptian shipyards and commissioned Christian workmen to build them a fleet that they could not have built themselves. They hired Christian mercenaries to do their navigation and their sailing. In 649, this entirely mercenary fleet enabled the Muslims to invade Cyprus, Sicily, and the island of Rhodes and conquer these Christian islands for Islam with Christian mercenary seamen. At this point, an opportunity arose that would have enabled the Christian Byzantine Empire to regain all their losses as the Muslim world erupted in a vicious civil war, which is normal. Muslims regularly get into civil wars and they kill more of one another than any crusaders ever have. Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, Ali, waged war against Muawara, the cousin of the murdered Caliph Uthman. Ali was murdered and Muawani became Caliph. Now this is normal. Just about all the caliphs murdered one another. That's about the way how Muslims changed their leadership. So from this point, Islam was divided into Sunni and Shiites. The Sunnis are more book-oriented, the Quran. The Shiites are more leadership-oriented, the Ayatollah. However, the Christian world failed to take advantage of this opportunity to regain their lost territories. At this time, with the exception of conquered Egypt, the entire north coast of Africa was still under the rule of the Byzantine Empire. The Arabs now targeted the desert-dwelling Berbers, many of whom converted to Judaism in the past. And after much bloodshed and bitter resistance, the Berber tribe was subjugated and enlisted as Arabs, as the Arabs' allies. And to this day, the Berbers remain mostly Muslim. In 698, a combined Arab and Berber army of 40,000 swept the coastal cities, taking the ancient capital of Carthage, which in 705 was razed to the ground, burned, most of its inhabitants massacred. In 711, an army of 10,000 Muslims from Morocco crossed the Mediterranean at its narrowest western point to land at Gibraltar, southernmost point of Europe, on the southwest coast of Spain. King Rodrigo marched the hastily assembled army south from his capital in Toledo, and he was defeated at the Battle of the River Guadalete. The king was drowned, and the Berber Tariq ibn Ziyad sent the king's head to the caliph in Damascus. Within 7 years, the Moors, as the Spanish called the Muslim invaders from Morocco, had brought most of Spain under Islam, which they called Al-Andalus, and later the Caliphate of Cordoba. The Muslims called Spain the Emirate of Cordoba, and on the site of a Christian cathedral, they built a large mosque in the city of Cordoba. There were numerous Muslim invasions of Sicily, 652, 720, 667, each of which were defeated. They were unsuccessful invasions. But then in 827, the Muslims invaded again with 10,000 troops. And while local Christians fought back furiously, it took more than 70 years for the Muslims to conquer Sicily after much fighting and many massacres. Palermo fell in 831, Syracuse in 878, Taormina held out until 902 AD. And from Sicily, the Muslims now started to invade Italy, conquering Taranto and Bari. You may wonder, how did they manage to keep themselves going for so long? Loot. Muslims do not produce much. They steal. They loot. They live off other people's productivity. Their main way of accumulating wealth is to take it from other people. And, of course, oil fits into that, because we discovered the oil in Saudi Arabia. Christians brought it out of the ground. Christians refined it. Christians sent it off to fuel our industries and our motor vehicles that we'd invented. And the Muslims got paid for it. They didn't have to do any work. They just happened to have their tents pitched over where the oil was under the ground. Their good fortune. But that's the way how they benefit. It's from other people's work, not their own. They have slaves to do the work. And so when they've looted one area, they need to invade a new area to parasite and loot off. When they've wrecked that country, they need to move into another country. They are migrants in that sense. And so they looted the historic city of Rome in 843. And all the famous churches were looted in 846. The Muslim occupation of Sicily and southern Italy lasted for 200 years. Cyprus was invaded, conquered by the Muslims. Rhodes, Sardinia, Majorca, all these islands invaded and taken. An island of Crete even, and then Malta fell in 835. Plainly, the popular propaganda that Islam was only advancing peacefully and that jihad is only a defensive concept is fiction. It's a lie. Islam has been aggressive, expansionist, plundering from the very beginning. What were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain? It should be noted that at that time, most of the armies of Persia and Byzantine Empire were actually poorly trained. They were used for static defense of strong points like a garrison or a walled city. They were not trained in maneuvers for battle. So the Byzantine Empire was overstretched. They had insufficient soldiers to protect their overstretched, vast empire, and therefore they were vulnerable to these kind of attacks. Most of the soldiers employed by both the Byzantines and the Persians were foreigners who served mainly for pay and had no real allegiance to countries, and many of these were Arabs, most of whom ended up deserting the Muslim side anyway when it came to a fight. So they were worse than useless. The use of camels provided the Arab invaders with superior mobility, particularly across the deserts. Even the Arab cavalry rode between the battles on camels, leaving the horses behind them. The camels enabled the Muslims to outflank the imperial forces by using desert routes. And whenever confronted by a superior force, they would just flee, withdrawn to the desert to avoid battle. This greater mobility enabled the Arabs to select and attack smaller forces and destroy them before reinforcements could be sent. The imperial forces of Byzantium made themselves vulnerable by spreading themselves out too thinly, trying to defend everywhere at once, and then wore themselves out marching in fruitless pursuit of a battle which the Arabs always avoided. They would only fight when they vastly outnumbered the Christians. These battles the Arabs normally avoided until they greatly outnumbered their enemies, and then they had a fairly sure chance of success. The immensity of the Byzantine Empire stretched the Byzantine forces far too thin. Sometimes to consolidate makes more sense. However, the Arabs concentrated the forces to attack a specific area at one time, and their motivation was the loot. When they took the town, they stole, looted, raped, enslaved at will, and this is what motivated the armies. And this is how the Islamic Caliphate stretched from Saudi Arabia through Asia, North Africa, even into Europe. Muslim propaganda makes great claims as to the tremendous tolerance which is meant to have been shown by Muslim rulers to Christian subjects. Actually, these claims began with Voltaire, the man who inspired the French Revolution. Voltaire and other 18th century humanists continually tried to cast Christians in the worst possible light, and in this case they invented the fiction of Islamic tolerance. This isn't something the Muslims invented, this is actually something the secular humanists, the revolutionaries invented, just as a stick to hit Christians with. It was a complete lie, but you can see how it's being used to this day. The Muslims are so tolerant and peaceful. There's no evidence that that ever was so. It just is that what the humanists were saying, because not because they understood Islam, but because they hated Christianity. So they were pretending that Islam was so much more tolerant and peaceful than Christianity, just because they wanted a stick to beat the Christians with. From the very beginning, Muslim authorities went to great lengths to humiliate and to punish dhimmis. You know what a dhimmi is? In a Muslim country, we would be considered a dhimmi, a non-Muslim. A non-Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, who refused to convert to Islam had to pay extra taxes. Maybe 4-8 times more taxes than the Muslims. They would be humiliated in different ways. They couldn't wear the same kind of clothes. They couldn't ride on horses. They weren't allowed weapons. They had to feel themselves inferior. They made them publicly humiliated. They passed laws that Christians could not ride a horse. Christians were compelled to wear marks of their religion when amongst Muslims. Non-Muslims were prohibited from wearing clothing similar to that of Muslims. Non-Muslims were forbidden to carry weapons. All the Muslims were armed. All the Christians had to be disarmed. It makes it easier for the Muslims to kill you if you disarm. And so they preferred disarmed victims. If both have weapons, you can have a war. If only one side has weapons, you can have a massacre. Non-Muslims were severely taxed. No new churches were allowed to be built. Jews and Christians were prohibited from praying aloud, or even reading the scriptures aloud, even in their own homes, in case a Muslim walking by may hear the scriptures or Christian prayer and be offended by it. In 705, the Muslim invaders of Armenia assembled all the Christian nobles in a church and burned them to death inside. Massacres of Jews and Christians are common throughout the history of Islam. Just a few examples. In Morocco, over 6,000 Jews were killed in 1033. Even more were murdered in Granada. Tens of thousands of Christians were massacred by Muslim invaders of Cyprus in 1570. Any Muslim who converted to another faith was condemned to death, often being crucified. Today, those who attempt to portray Muslims as enlightened supporters of multicultural tolerance are either ignorant or dishonest. And that's what you've got today with people like Obama, trying to say that the Muslims are also tolerant and the Christians are the ones who are intolerant and the Crusades are to blame for what we are facing today. Just absolute nonsense. Despite Muhammad's assurance that it was impossible for Islamic armies to ever be defeated by infidels, Muslim armies have suffered numerous defeats throughout the centuries. In 672, the Caliph Moawiyah attempted to conquer the capital of the Byzantine Empire, Constantinople, the most eastern city of Europe on the Bosphorus, right on the European side, but facing the east. With a massive fleet that this Muslim had built up, which was built by Egyptian Christians, mind you, he transported 50,000 fighting men through the Dardanelles, the narrow strait leading to the Mediterranean, from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea. An Islamic assault on Constantinople in 672 was described as the fiercest which had ever been launched by infidels against a Christian stronghold. Numerous historians hailed the Christian victory over the Muslims assailing Constantinople as a turning point in the history of mankind. The fact that it held saved not only the Byzantine Empire but the whole of European civilization. Had the Muslims captured Constantinople in the 7th century rather than the 15th century, all of Europe and America might be Muslim today. And it's true. If they had captured Europe before the Reformation, where would our faith have come from? Despite modern myths about the supposed superiority of Islamic culture and their technology being so advanced, the fact is Christians did possess superior technology and they used it to defeat the Muslims on numerous occasions. The walls of Constantinople were an engineering marvel, a massive outer wall with towers and superb battlements. Behind it, an even stronger inner wall, 40 feet high and 15 feet thick. The Christians had what was called Greek fire. The Greek engineer Kalinikos of Heliopolis had developed an incendiary weapon, a fire weapon, which literally burned up or destroyed the Muslim fleet. Greek fire was a primitive flamethrower, which included a pump which discharged a stream of flaming liquid through a tube projected from the bow of their galley. They could use their catapults also to hurtle pottery containing Greek fire, which was burning fuel, over 400 to 500 meters away. When it struck, it shattered the pot and then burst into flame, spreading its burning liquids over large areas of the enemy, and on several occasions the Byzantines rode out and incinerated the entire Muslim navy. With their fleet burning to a cinder, the Arab invaders soon were stranded and starving. They had lost their supplies, they had lost their transport. Discouraged and demoralized, Moawiyah surrendered and agreed to pay a tribute every year of 300 pounds of gold to Byzantine for the grace of being allowed to go free and alive. In 717, the Muslims once again tried to conquer Constantinople, so it seemed being gracious to them did not help. A massive fleet of 1,800 rowing ships or galleys attacked Constantinople. The Greek Christians again rode out with the Greek fire pumps, destroyed virtually the entire Muslim fleet. Most of the Muslim attackers either burned or drowned. The next year, 718, the Muslims tried again with a new fleet, and this again was destroyed by Greek fire. Most of those galleys that managed to flee were then destroyed in a devastating storm. Only five Muslim galleys survived the attack of 718. 747, another huge Muslim armada of 1,000 galleys was annihilated by a vastly smaller Byzantine fleet off the island of Cyprus. Only three Arab ships survived that engagement. 3 out of 1,000. While the Muslim ambitions of conquering southern Eastern Europe were frustrated by the apparently impregnable Constantinople, Muslim armies gained far greater success on the western edge of the Mediterranean, conquering Spain. In 721, the Caliph of Aldova, or Spain, led his forces north of the Pyrenees Mountains to sack the French city of Toulouse. And for 3 months, the city resisted his siege. Then Duke Odo of Aquitaine mobilized an army of Franks to lift the siege of Toulouse. The Muslims were taken by surprise and most of them were slaughtered as they fled before the Christian cavalry. In 732, Ibn al-Rahman mobilized a massive army of 80,000 fighting men to invade Gaul, what today is France. They moved north from Spain into France, plundering cities, laying waste to the countryside. Muslim historians record that Al-Rahman burned churches and imagined that he could pillage or loot the basilica, the cathedral of St. Martin of Tours. An Arab historian notes that the hearts of Ibn al-Rahman and his captains and his men were filled with wrath, anger, and with pride. He was to meet his match in Charles Martel, the Hammer. Martel, the son of King Pippin of the Franks, was an unusually tall and powerfully built man. Charles Martel was already famous for military victories, great exploits. He was perhaps the only man in Christendom at that time who could have provided a serious challenge to these advancing Muslim armies. The Muslims were totally taken by surprise when they found their path to St. Martin's of Tours blocked by dense lines of well-armed infantry on the crest of a hill. With forests on both sides, Martel had chosen his battlefield well, forcing the Muslims to charge uphill. For 7 days, skirmishes were fought before Al-Rahman ordered his cavalry to charge the Christian Franks, the French. Charles Martel had his men closely packed, forming a solid shield wall with their long spears thrust into the ground to deter the cavalry. One contemporary wrote to the Franks, "Firmly they stood, one close to another, forming as it were a bulwark of ice." 6 times the Arab cavalry charged the Frankish lines, and each time they were repulsed with severe casualties. Soon the battlefield was filled with vast numbers of dead and dying, and repeated furious charge of the Arab cavalry seemed to have absolutely no effect on the steadfast Christians who stood resolutely in their ranks. When the Muslims heard that some of the Franks had broken into the camp and started to take their loot, they fled the field to protect their loot. So they were more concerned about the loot than anything else. At this, the Franks unleashed their cavalry, who inflicted even more severe casualties on the fleeing Muslims. At least 10,000 died that afternoon fleeing the field. Among the dead lay Caliph Ibn al-Rahman. Even at this point, Charles Martel maintained the discipline of his infantry, leaving the pursuit to the cavalry. His men stood firm, and they remained for the 7th day. They'd been standing for 6 days. Nobody had been allowed to move. They had to stand in their ranks and prepare to withstand these attacks. And they slept in their ranks. The next morning, the scouts reported the Muslims had fled, leaving empty tents, siege engines behind. They'd fled back beyond the Pyrenees Mountains to Spain. That was not the end of the Islamic threat to France. When the Muslims tried to invade Gaul again in 735, Charles Martel and the Franks gave them another severe beating. The decisive Battle of Tours, or Poitiers, is one of the most important battles in the history of the world. It was a major turning point, absolutely essential to the survival of not just Western civilization, but Christian civilization. If the Muslims had conquered the heartland of Europe at that time, there would not have been a Reformation, there would not have been the Great Evangelical Awakening, there wouldn't have been the Great Missionary Movement. Christianity would have been snuffed out in its heartland at a critical time. In 759, the last foothold of Islam in southeastern France was retaken. The Muslim armies never again crossed the Pyrenees, which is the border between France and Spain, the Pyrenees Mountains. In fact, they now began to be defeated even in Spain. The Muslims never conquered all of Spain. There was always some resistance, some Spanish stalwarts who stood firm on the northern coast of Spain in the Bay of Biscay, known as the Asturias. From the Christian kingdom of Asturias, the Muslims started to be beaten. And beginning in 741, the reconquista, or the reconquest of Spain, began. And the first area to be liberated from the Muslim invaders was Galicia. In 778, the grandson of Charles Martel, Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, marched 2 armies into Spain, began the liberation of southwestern Spain from Islam. Within a few years, Charlemagne's army had forced the Muslims south of Barcelona. The fall of Toledo on 1085 was a strategic and psychological disaster for the Muslims. You might know of Toledo steel, some of the finest swords in the world made in Toledo, very important manufacturing city. In 1092, King Alfonso VI of Castile called back Spain's most famous knight from exile, Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar, known as El Cid, and he liberated Valencia in 1094. He defeated the Muslims time and again. El Cid is a legend in Spain even to this day. Frequently he seized initiative and he charged the besieging forces, turning the tide and inflicting decisive defeats on the Muslim occupiers. In Valencia he turned 9 mosques into Christian churches. Charlton Heston has played the role of El Cid in a famous Hollywood film. El Cid's resounding victories, often against overwhelming odds, inspired Christians throughout Europe that the Muslim invaders could be defeated. In 873, the Byzantine Emperor Basil I defeated the Muslims throughout Dalmatia and liberated much of southern Italy from the Muslim invaders. In 1038, the Byzantines determined to put an end to Muslim piracy by liberating the island of Sicily, which was their base of operations. This invasion was well-timed because the emirs in Sicily had turned on one another and were involved in one of the many internal conflicts and betrayals that frequently erupt in the Muslim world. George Maniakas employed Lombardian mercenaries and Norman knights, Vikings, to help liberate Sicily. The Vikings were unbeatable. Within 2 years, over a dozen major fortresses had been taken, major battles had been won, Messina and Syracuse were in Christian hands. However, when the Byzantines alienated the Vikings, William of Hautville, or Iron Arm, led the Norsemen, the Vikings, to seize the southernmost province of Italy, and although vastly outnumbered, the Normans or the Vikings routed the Byzantines time and again. To employ the Vikings made sense, to betray the Vikings was foolish. They were the best soldiers the world's ever seen. Iron Arm and his Vikings prevailed, and the Byzantines never again attempted to fight an open battle with them in Italy. Southern Italy was then transformed into a Norman or Viking kingdom. In 1061, Robert Guiscard, Duke of Southern Italy, determined to seize Sicily, first conquering Messina and then Palermo. In 1098, Robert Guiscard's eldest son, Behmont, led the Crusader forces that took the city of Antioch. Behmont became the ruler of the Kingdom of Antioch, and from the time of the Norman conquest of Sicily, the Muslims never again regained control over that island. Now these are just a few examples, I've just taken a few examples here and there, of Christian victories and Muslim defeats before the Crusades began. So the myth of Islamic invincibility is plainly propaganda. Before the knights of Europe marched or sailed to the Holy Land, they really knew a lot about their Muslim invaders. Most importantly, they knew how to beat them, how to defeat them in battle. Psalm 72:9-11 says, the desert tribes will bow down to Christ, and his enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to Christ. All nations will serve him. Any questions on understanding the Crusades? Questions? Comments? Yes. That is a very good question. What are the Americans doing in Iraq? And in fact, I don't think they're doing much at all right now except undermining the situation, because it seems that Iraq was better off before the American invasion and it's much worse off now. Now, of course, America did have the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001 and they had to react against the Muslim terrorists. So any country that was supporting or hosting the terrorists that attacked them, they felt they should attack, which was, of course, in one case, Afghanistan, the other, Iraq. But unfortunately, instead of just liberating the country and then destroying the terrorist bases and withdrawing, they did a lot of foolish things, like staying for the next 11 years, and also they destroyed the entire high command structure. The Iraqis had a good army, and they shouldn't have dismissed them all. And what they did actually was take away the social cohesion by firing the entire police force and army and the whole social service, of course the country went into chaos. Because if you defeat a country, it's important to keep as much of the local structures and leadership in place as you possibly can. But by undermining it, they led to chaos. Instead of having a strong government, which under Saddam Hussein was secular, and he kept the Muslims under their thumb, now they had democracy, American style, which meant radical Muslims gained control of the country, and the country just got worse and worse, and the Christians were being persecuted even more. So it's a disastrous thing what happened in Iraq. Saddam Hussein, do you know, he gave full religious freedom to the Christians. He didn't interfere with the Christians. The Christians had such freedom under Saddam Hussein that you can go to this day to the Baptist church in Baghdad and the big organ has got on it a plaque, gift of His Excellency the President Saddam Hussein. All of his bodyguards were Christians. All of his cooks were Christians. Saddam Hussein, do you know why? Because Christians don't assassinate. He knew he could trust Christian bodyguards. He could not trust Muslim bodyguards. They might stab him in the back one day or poison him. So he made sure his cooks were Christian and his bodyguards were Christian. And he knew they would protect him because they knew if he was replaced, a Muslim would persecute them. So it was in their interest. And so America's actually made the situation much worse in Iraq. It's sadly so. Could we also distribute the books I've brought here? Islam book. This book I first wrote in 2005 and it got me a death threat fatwa from the Muslims for producing this history book. I then doubled the size. This is the second edition and distributed these. These became so valuable they were being sold for over $1,000 on Amazon.com for first and second editions. They were so in demand, and we only sell them for $10, and literally Amazon.com online was selling this first for hundreds and then over $1,000 a copy. So this became so valuable because they're illegal in many countries in the world, of course, but these Muslim this history on Islam got me death threats. So we've produced three editions now and gone to fourth edition. You've got here the second edition. It's double the size of the first edition. And you'll see the notes of what I gave you yesterday also on Islam according to the Reformers is page 47, chapter 5. So what the Reformers taught in Islam, you've got that in chapter 5. You've got here on resisting Sharia in Nigeria, uprooting terrorism, the scourge of slavery. There's a lot of different details on Islam. Also how to evangelize Muslims, comparing the Quran with the Bible, comparing Muhammad with Jesus, and it's even got at the end different appendixes which include the story of the death threats from Muslim extremists I received in page 160 and the end of Islam and many different charts, diagrams, maps which will help you to know Islam. This has got also page 145, a glossary of Islamic terms, their words in Arabic and what it means in English, so you can understand some of the important things Islam teaches. So this is an important textbook. This is yours. Put your name in it. Make notes. And although we are not specifically focusing on Islam during this church history this week, it's an important resource for you. So you've got here everything the Muslims do not want you to know about Islam and its history. Any other questions?
Happened at that time, and also what are some things like lessons help us to face the
such an important question. The first thing to learn is Islam is not peaceful and tolerant. They are the most violent and intolerant religion in the history of the world. They're the greatest threat to civilization and freedom the world has ever seen. Even greater than communism, if that is possible for anyone to believe, because communism did a lot of damage. But still, Islam is the biggest threat to the church. They're the largest block of unreached people for the church to reach. They're the worst persecutors of the Christian church. They're a challenge we cannot ignore. Our churches must understand Islam. We need to teach our people about Islam, which is why I want you to have this book, so that you've got a resource of material on what Islam teaches and what Islam has done. We've got to understand the history of Islam. We must. They're our biggest enemy. You must know your enemy. They're also our biggest mission field. We must learn how to win Muslims to Christ. And Muslims are being won to Christ. In Sudan, hundreds of thousands of people from Muslim background have come to Christ. In Nigeria, hundreds of thousands of people from Muslim background have come to Christ. It's wonderful to win our enemies to Christ. And then they can become our brothers. That is important. But having said that, at the end of the day, most Muslims will not be converted to Christ. And they will continue to be a threat. And we will have to fight them. Not that we want to. We have not declared war on Islam. But they have declared war on us. They are attacking Christians in Nigeria. They're attacking Christians in Sudan. They're attacking Christians in Kenya. They're attacking Christians even in Tanzania. They're a threat. They're a clear and present danger throughout the world. Even people going to a coffee shop in Sydney, Australia, could be kidnapped by Muslim jihadists. Even some Canadian soldier standing by a monument in Ottawa could be attacked and murdered by a Muslim. Even the parliament of the Canadians was invaded by Muslim terrorists. Even a New York policeman was attacked with an axe by a Muslim terrorist wielding an axe recently. Even the undergrounds in London could be attacked by Muslim suicide bombers. Where in the world are you safe from Islamic terrorism? If it hasn't happened in your town, praise God, but it could. In fact, it's likely to at some stage. So we need to prepare our people. We are starting with security and survival seminars to try and train Christians. We've got to get our Christians back into the mindset of defending and protecting and being alert. In fact, I believe every church should have a security ministry. Or at least a security deacon, if it's a very small church and you don't have the size. But at least one person who's tasked with security concerns. And there's a lot of things we can do, practically. And we're going to, I've been asked by the principal to take tomorrow PT and self-defense classes from 3 o'clock, Wednesday 3 to 5. And that's just an introductory to some aspects of the security and survival. But we're talking about in the second semester having a security and survival week where we deal with how can we prepare and protect our churches effectively and our communities, which could be vulnerable to Islamic attack. But in time, our countries need to think in terms of what are armed forces for? What are our armies for, if not to protect our people and our churches and our communities? And so the most likely threat the armies of all of your countries are going to have to face is Islamic terrorism. We need to get together, and at a certain point, it may be that Christian countries and peoples will think in terms of a new crusade, where there will be a unity. And this will not just necessarily be Christians. We might find we've got Russia and India joining up with others to fight against the radical Islamic regimes. India has suffered a lot at the hands of Muslim terrorists. They even have attacked their capital. They've had Muslim terrorists attacking them in India. You've heard about some of these horrible things that have taken place there. Well, we need to be prepared. And I do believe the time will come in our lifetime when there will be such an open resistance against Islam that it might be called another crusade. I think it's going to come again. The first thing is we should learn from these lessons I've just gone through is you cannot trust Muslims in your own army. This is one of the big problems in Nigeria. I don't know if you've heard of it. But when the Muslims have gone wild killing Christians, the Nigerian armies often stayed in the barracks because they couldn't trust their own army. If they mobilized them, there were too many Muslims amongst them. They were afraid they might join the terrorists in attacking the Christians. And so there's terrible problems when you've got armies that are infiltrated with Muslims as well as Christians. You cannot trust Muslims to be patriotic. When it comes to choice, you can see, like with Barack Hussein Obama, he said, if there's ever a time when America is fighting Muslims, I will take the side of the Muslims. They've got an American president who says his allegiance is with Islam, not with America. And he's shown it. He's proven it. He's done more to help the Muslim terrorists than anyone else in the last century. And so I do believe we need to start thinking strategically. It took the Christians a while to wake up to the threat of Islam. It took them a while to mobilize resistance. But whenever they did, they won. When we fight, we win. But if we don't fight, we'll surely lose. And so I do think we've got to change the mindset of our churches. Many of our people are passive, pacifist, neutral, or super spiritual. Look, when you pray, give us this day our daily bread, it doesn't mean that you should not go out and plow the field, scatter the corn, irrigate, cultivate, and harvest. It doesn't mean that you don't go to the shop and buy those food products and bring it home and cook and prepare it. When you pray, Lord, protect us on the road, it doesn't mean you don't put your safety belt on. That's just good common sense. When you pray, Lord, may you give me good health, it doesn't stop you going to the dentist when you've got a toothache. We use the means that God has put within our... We expect it to do what we can and trust God to do what we cannot. But it is laziness and foolishness for us to do nothing to protect our families, our homes and our churches and say, Lord, protect us. We should be like David, who went against Goliath and said, you come with your spear, your shield and your javelin. I come in the name of the Lord God of hosts, whom you have defied. David did not say, I am coming to you with the trust in my sling. He took his sling, but he didn't put his trust in the sling, his trust was in the Lord. He took the weapon he knew best, and he used it, and he beat Goliath. And then he took Goliath's sword and he chopped off Goliath's head to make sure he didn't get up again. King David is the writer of the Psalms, the hymn book of the Bible, the prayer book of the Bible, the middle book of the Bible, the biggest book of the Bible. And the Psalms are full of prayers before battle and praises to God after battle. The Bible is not a pacifist book. We as Christians should not be pacifist. We must get the warrior spirit again. We need to be considering again what it takes to fight, to defend Christian civilization. If the Muslims want to come and destroy this Bible college or your church or kidnap your family, you need to know how to fight and resist them. And you need to be good neighbors with others who under attack, that we can work together to protect. There are more of us than there are of the Muslims. There are more Christians in the world than Muslims. There are more Christians in Africa than Muslims in Africa. And yet, we let the Muslims run around killing people in our churches and our shopping centers, and we're not resisting enough. And that's wrong. And yet, what do we get? We get Christians standing up condemning the Crusades. So I'm telling you, let us not condemn what we do not understand. If we understand the Crusades, and we may not criticize them, we may actually be grateful to them and think, what can I learn from them that we could do a better job this time? Because I believe we're coming to a new war. We're already in it. The Muslims have declared war on us. If you were living in Egypt today, or Syria, or Iraq, or northern Nigeria, you would not be thinking one day we might be at war with the Muslims. You would know you're already at war. Or should I say they're at war with us. We did not want this war with Islam, but they have declared that war with us. Speak to our brother from Sudan. It's not that the people of Sudan wanted to fight the Muslims. They were happy to be peaceful with them. They were happy to be good neighbors. No South Sudanese wanted a war with Sudan. But the Arabs attacked them and enslaved them and did terrible things. And so the people of South Sudan grudgingly were forced to defend their homes and to fight for their freedom until South Sudan is free and independent. Why? They had no choice. They didn't want war. But war was forced on them and the South Sudanese won. And the Arabs had to withdraw. And today they've recognized South Sudan as an independent country. That's a great victory. And the people in South Sudan have shown us that Islam can be beaten. And it must be beaten if we want freedom. You cannot have peace with the Muslims ruling over you. If they rule over you, they will enslave your young people, they will kill your pastors, they'll destroy your churches. That's what they've done thousands of times in our lifetime. When are we going to wake up and see the threat of Islam? Have I spoken fairly of the situation in Sudan? Any other comments or questions? Yes. Very good question. We are commanded to love God with all of our heart, soul, strength and mind. We are to love our parents. We are to love our brothers and sisters in Christ. We are to love our neighbors. And we are also to love our enemies. Now love for your enemy is not more important than love for God and your parents and your brothers and sisters in Christ and your neighbors. But love for your enemy is one of the things you do. Yeah? So, let's get things straight. First things first. God first. Now, you must love your enemies. But nothing says you must love God's enemies. Does anyone here love Satan? Why? You've got to love your enemies. Why don't you love Satan? Why don't you love Satan? He's your enemy, isn't he? He's God's enemy. That's the point. You don't love God's enemy. You love your enemy. Now, a person who's unfair to me. He spoke behind my back. He gossiped. He hurt me. Maybe he bullied me. I must forgive my enemy. I mustn't hold bitterness and hatred in my heart. That will poison him. I must forgive my enemy, even if he doesn't deserve it. I didn't deserve God's forgiveness either. Lord, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. This is the Lord's prayer. I must pray this every day. And I must have forgiveness in my heart for my enemies. But that does not say I do not fight against the enemies of God. So, for example, a friend of mine, one of our missionaries, Charles van Weyck, he was in church on Sunday the 25th of July 1993. In Cape Town, St. James Church of England, the biggest evangelistic church in Cape Town at that time. Bishop Frank Retief was a pastor, good friend of ours. My father was converted in that church. My brother was converted in the church. St. James is a church that was one block away, closer to our mission headquarters in our home than the chapel is to this lecture hall right now. And on Sunday night, the 25th of July, 1993, terrorists kicked down the door, opened fire with machine guns. They came from Libya, Pan-African Congress, trained by Gaddafi's people. And they machine gunned the congregation. And they threw hand grenades at the church. Now at first, Charles was sitting there and he saw this happen. And he thought this is maybe a play that the youth are putting on in the church to communicate something. But then he saw pieces of a person's skull with hair on it, flying, woman's hair, flying towards him, and splinters from the pews as wood starts flying around, and blood. And he knew this is not a play. And he drew his revolver, dropped to one knee, and he fired over the, balanced on the pew, and hit the terrorist at the door. And as he got wounded, they all fled. Now, in just those few seconds before Sharp shot back, 11 people had got murdered. Marika Ackerman, beautiful lady. Three mothers murdered. One man, Dimitri Makgon, had both his legs blown off and his arm blown off. A grenade fell in his lap. And he survived incredibly, but he lost two legs and an arm. One man, Jared Harker, 21 years old, he saw the hand grenade land in the passageway, the aisle, between the pews, and he jumped on top of the grenade to absorb the impact in his own body, because he knew there's so many people around on both sides that would get killed, including his younger brother, who was 17, who fell on top and took the full weight of the impact of his. I saw his body, just the blood all around, huge pool of blood, but he died to save lives around him. Another man, Richard, killed, just 17 years old, pushed a girl down and covered her with his body and took a bullet through the head. Was killed, Richard. Richard, Jared Harker, and Scholfenbeck saved lives. Two of the men gave their lives for others. Another one fired back. But all of them helped save lives and sent the terrorists packing. The terrorists were going to, they had 6 to 8 grenades each and 5 to 6 clips of ammunition each. They fired one clip of ammunition through 2 hand grenades before Charles shot back, and then the rest fled when they got resistance. After St. James, they're going to attack Christchurch, church up the road, also in Kenilworth. So they're going to hit 2 churches, one after the other. But after they got resistance and one wounded, the first church they fled. The police said Charles saved hundreds of lives that night by shooting back. Now, 5 terrorists in a church packed with 1,500 people, they could have killed a lot of people. And after shooting them, Shaw went out the door, he went out a back door and came around the side, and he saw them by their vehicles with firearms ready, assault rifles, waiting for the people to flee out the church, and then they were going to machine gun more as they came out of church. He fired at them again and they fled. Now, that's one case, one example. He shot back. Some people said, how could he do this? What about loving his enemies? He said, well, I've got to love my family first, and God's church, and my neighbors who have been killed. You know what he did? He went and helped the police identify the terrorists. He testified in court, saw 3 of them put in jail, and then he visited them in prison. And the one he had shot and wounded, he took him a Bible, he prayed with him, he shared the gospel with him in prison. He later, when they were released by Bishop Tutu, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and Mandela gave them all pardons and let all these people go back. Shah went to their villages, to their families, to their homes, and shared the gospel with them there. So he showed love for God, love for his parents, love for his family, love for his neighbors, his brothers and sisters in Christ, and he showed love for his enemies too. To me, that's balanced. Now, I've been a soldier. I have fought on the border against the Cubans and the Russians and the communists in Angola and Southwest Africa and Namibia. I've been involved in the war. And I fought the enemy. But I have taken the gospel to the communists on many occasions. When I was in the army and also as a missionary, I've gone to terrorist bases. I've shown the Jesus film. I've brought the gospel to many. Put the AK-47s in the dust, knelt with me, and gave their lives to Christ. I've baptized communist terrorists in the name of Christ who were converted. Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe. Had the opportunity of winning enemies to Christ. I've witnessed to Pan-African Congress, ANC and others. In fact, even recently when ANC had the 103rd anniversary in Cape Town, I was just reading thousands of gospel tracts. They're my enemies. We fought them. But I shared the gospel with them. I want to bring them to Christ. And I spent an hour with Nelson Mandela sharing the gospel with him. Nelson Mandela, when he was president, called for me to come to his mansion, the president's mansion, and he asked me, Mr. Hammond, what were you doing in the years of struggle? I said, I was fighting people like you, sir. He laughed and he stood up and he shook my hand. He said, I'm so glad to meet an honest white man. So many have said they always supported me. I wondered how the National Party stayed in power for 44 years when everyone was supporting me. I said, well, Mr. President, make no mistake. We were not fighting for apartheid. We were fighting against communism and against terrorism. And we had a good discussion, and he appreciated the fact that I was, and I challenged him with the gospel, and I prayed with him, and I put gospel material in his hands while he was present, because although I oppose him politically, yet I love him as my enemy, and I want him to receive the gospel and to be converted. And I've had the joy of leading many communists and Muslims to Christ. So to me, there is no conflict between loving God, loving my neighbor, loving my parents, loving my brothers and sisters in Christ, and loving my enemy. I will never be cruel to my enemy. We would never mistreat a captured enemy. We never mistreated any terrorist or communist that we captured. I've shared the gospel with captured Muslims in Sudan. The SPLA had prison camps and they invited me to come. And I went in there to share the gospel. We've shown that Jesus home to Muslim jihadists in South Sudan. When they've been, they've been so angry. And the SPLA is standing there with their rifles, holding them at bay with the bayonets, because they want to come and tear me apart while I'm preaching the gospel. And I had the SPLA standing right between me and them, literally with the bayonets pressed against them. You know, otherwise they would have attacked me and we would have been fighting. But I was preaching the gospel to them. So I love my enemies. I love my enemies enough to want to bring them to Christ. But if they are threatening my family or my church or my family or any neighbors who are Christians, I will do everything I can to bring them down. I will not hesitate for a second. If I am threatened, or if any of my loved ones are threatened by Muslim or communist terrorists or any other violent characters that might seek to attack, I will use whatever force is necessary to take them down. But once the threat is neutralized, I will be glad to treat them well and to share the gospel with them. And so I think this is how we need to look at it. We do not hate the Muslims. We want them to come to Christ. We would prefer them to be converted. We do not want to fight them. I've even heard that in Sudan. I've heard Sudanese soldiers, SPLA, who fought for years, saying, we don't hate the Muslims. They are our brothers. We want them to come to Christ. They did not have hatred of them. They had to fight them because of survival. It was not a matter of hatred. The Muslims may hate us, but we do not hate them. We want what's good for them. We would never do terrorism against Muslims. We're not going to do bombs in them. We wouldn't hurt their family members. We would use what force is necessary to stop their threat, and then we would be kind to them as defeated enemies. And we would certainly never take war to their family members. It just is unthinkable. Christians don't do that. So we have to think in a balanced Christian way. And to me, this is how we love our neighbor and our enemy. So, any more questions? Good question. How can I tell the difference between my enemy and God's enemy? My enemy is somebody who has abused me, broken my trust, stolen from me, hurt me, bullied me, spoken behind my back, gossiped. My enemy is somebody who in any way has personally offended me. God's enemy would be those who burn his churches, who murder his people, who abort babies, who destroy God's creation, those who have declared themselves against God, those who curse God and curse Christ, who ban the Bible, who forbid Christian ministry, who burn the churches, send suicide bombs. Those are God's enemies. But even having said that, it doesn't mean we don't want to win them to Christ, but we will fight them and oppose them. I will not fight over an insult. If somebody slaps me on the one cheek, I turn the other. Jesus said, if somebody slaps you on the one cheek, let him slap you on the other too. Jesus did not say, if somebody stabs you in the one cheek, let him stab you in the heart as well. He didn't say, if they attack your mother, let them attack your sister too. That Jesus did not say. He said, if somebody slaps you. Now, you know, in the old English culture, they'd fling down the gauntlet, they'd take a glove and slap the person in the face with the glove and fling down the gauntlet. And that was a challenge. A duel to the death. I demand satisfaction. Pistols at dawn. Back to one another. You walk 10 paces, you turn and you fight. Or a duel with a sword. Men fought for pride. They fought over an insult. A person felt insulted and he'd fling the gauntlet at someone, slap him in the face, and then they'd go and they'd fight to the death. That is pride. And the Bible is clear, we do not fight over an insult. If somebody slaps you on the one cheek, you turn to him the other. But Jesus did not say, even if he strikes you with a fist, this might hurt. This is just an insult. It didn't say stab. Nothing in the teachings of Jesus or of the Bible tells us that we should not use self-defense. In fact, the Bible says that we are to defend our families. Nehemiah 4:14. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord is great and awesome. Fight for your brothers, your sisters, mothers, your homes. And so we as Christians need to make provision for the members of our own household. We've got to be willing to fight to defend what's right. So to me, that is the difference between God's enemy and our enemy. And remember, this don't fight over an insult is not the same thing as don't fight to defend someone whose life is in danger. A slap is not a threat to your life. It's just an insult. And we as Christians can turn the other cheek over something like that. That is not worth our fighting for. We don't fight for pride. We fight for survival. Any other comments? Yes. Distinction again, self-defense against a clear and present danger is one thing, but what about revenge after the fact? Now, you can think this much: if a person attacks you and they've got a habit of attacking innocent people, it's not a case that this is a once in a blue moon, never going to happen again incident. We know that Muslims are, for example, attacking churches regularly. And if they attack you, you are not their first target. And you will not be their last target. You're just one in a line of many targets. But by, for example, our missionary Charles shooting back at the terrorists at St. James, he didn't just save lives in that church by stopping the attack. He saved another church from being attacked that same night. And who knows how many other churches would have been attacked in the next weeks or months. So a little bit of resistance at the right time saved lives. Now, if you're in a village, say you're in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram is attacking villages. They're attacking churches. They're kidnapping schoolgirls, selling them as slaves. You know, if they attack your village, this is not the last village they're going to attack. So at that point, to get together a team and track them is not revenge. At that point, it is seeking not just justice, but a preemptive strike to prevent the next innocent targets to be attacked. So, that would not be revenge. Revenge would be somebody in a fight, some person maybe in a drunken brawl, attacked a friend of yours or family member, and now they back home, and maybe they're sober, and you find out about it tomorrow. If you go there and you now kill him, that's revenge. And the police can arrest you. What you should be doing now, in that case, is laying a charge with the police, getting it to go through the courts, getting this person to be brought to justice, getting them to have to defend themselves in court and hopefully get a sentence for what they did. So they must do restitution or whatever the courts decide. That would be justice, not revenge. But if you took the law into your own hands, you'd be guilty of a vengeance attack, and therefore they could charge you as well. In the case of terrorism, we're not dealing with revenge. We're dealing with preemptive strike to prevent future terrorist attacks. And so I would say that in a village where you know you're in a vulnerable community, perhaps in northern Nigeria or your Nuba Mountains, and you're attacked by terrorists, it is not revenge to start pursuing them the next day to seek to bring them to justice, because you know they're going to attack again. So that's wise for ongoing threat. So again, we've got to be balanced here. But again, if I capture the man, and I know he's done terrible things, I can't start to torture the man. And that's not Christian. We don't torture people. We don't mistreat them. We would fight and use all force necessary to stop them, to neutralize the threat, but we will not torture them. So obviously there's limits. That would then be cruel, unjust and evil, and that is not Christian. It is not a Christian thing to torture someone who's in your power. So how we treat the people we have captured also says a lot about us. We know the Muslims always torture. Now, I've been a prisoner. I know what it is to be tortured. There are people who have no conscience. And if they've got you in their power, they do horrible things because they've got the power to do it. But we as Christians, just because we've got the power to do it, doesn't mean we've got the right to do it. And so we will always be restrained because of our Christian convictions. Yes?
I understand, but you say that God is the right enemy, the one who is from the church. The man enemy is the one who is hidden in the man. Okay. For example, if the Muslim they come to destroy the church, in the moment if I am there in the church,
okay, now these are practical decisions. In some countries you may have the right to own firearms. In some countries you may not have the right to own firearms. I think every country should allow that right. But still, you've got to stay within the law. What can you have? Can you have bows and arrows? Can you make a crossbow? Crossbows are not difficult to make. They're very powerful. You've got even some of the suspension leaves of vehicles that are lying on the side of the road that are broken, that can be turned to for the crossbow, and you can make even metal crossbows, very strong, where it just takes cranking up. It's old Middle Ages technology, but a crossbow can fire a very deadly bolt. It used to go through armor and stop knights from 100 meters away. So crossbows, archery, getting back to the old archery practice and having good basic weapons available. It's I don't know any country that doesn't allow you to have archery classes or to practice with bow and arrow or to have crossbows. There are some different means of protection one can use. For example, most churches have got open windows for fresh air. But mosquito nets or chicken wire mesh on the inside of the windows would prevent them throwing a grenade through the window. It still allows free flow of air. You might have, instead of a security gate, you might have a wire mesh gate that you actually lock during the service. So the Muslim can't just charge in during the service. You could have an extra wall. So you've got your outer door, but you could have a wall just inside that sort of shields. And you've got a gate that is locked during the service to prevent. Many churches do that now to prevent people storming, and if somebody comes late, there'll be a deacon who's responsible, can see whether to let the people in. But once the service is started, the outer gate gets locked. There are means that one can do in order to make a church less vulnerable to the methods they use to attack. A thatched roof is very vulnerable to fire. Corrugated iron is less threatening. That if they throw some firebomb on, it'll just slide off. It's not going to burn. So we can think of some practical means, but I think teaching our people some basic methods of self-defense is important, and we'll look at some of that tomorrow. We'll have some practical string PC of how to disarm someone who's coming at you with different weapons, and how to be able to use self-defense and unarmed combat type of techniques. There's also knife fighting techniques. But I think our community should have some forms of weapons. And one thing you could do is to introduce archery classes, bows and arrows. The British won a lot of wars against the French and others with their archery because they're such good bowmen. And I think we've got a culture in Africa of bows and arrows. And I think we could bring it back. And I might say there's a lot of other good techniques that we can teach that can defend our communities. And some communities, like in Sudan, the people there do have firearms. They've captured them from the Arabs. they've now got a good amount of weapons. So if Arabs want to attack a church in South Sudan, they might be in horrible surprise because the people there are armed. The people in northern Nigeria are not armed. Most of the people there are in a very vulnerable state. So we as Christians need to think within the law, what practically can we do in accordance with what is available for us in our country to make our target less of an easy target? Because the Muslims are finding Christians a soft target. We need to harden our targets and make ourselves harder for the Muslims to get to, and also that our people are ready, mentally and emotionally and spiritually ready and practically ready to resist. And I believe we can do it. We've beaten the Muslims before. We can do it again. Our friends in South Sudan have beaten the Muslims in our lifetime, and they've shown us Islam can be beaten and we can protect our churches. So we must stop having this victim mentality. You know what Jesus said? You are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing. Except you're thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. If we are being trampled underfoot, we've got to ask ourselves, what has happened? What have we done wrong? We should not be the tail, we should be the head. The church is not called to be doormats. We're to be the light of the world. We're to be the salt of the earth. We are not to be thrown outside to be trampled underfoot. Right now the Muslims are trampling Christians underfoot because they don't respect us. If we fought hard, they'd respect us. They respect the Christians in South Sudan now. They know the Christians in South Sudan can fight and win. We need to show them again that Christians in Kenya can fight. The Christians in Tanzania can fight. We're not just going to let them come into our Westgate malls and murder our people without resistance. We will learn to beat you so the next time you come, you'll get a horrible surprise. I think that's got to be the attitude. We as Christians are not going to take it lying down like we're victims. We're called to be conquerors, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. The Lord Jesus calls us to be more than a conqueror, like King David. We're in the King David Hall right now, so we can talk like this. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Okay. Concerning the days of the Stephen, when he was dead, he was destroyed in the storm.
Yes.
At that time, and when we are doing another story of the dead, try to prevent them when they are stoning or when they are putting oil to them. So how we can match that close in our life?
Yes.
They didn't give any revenge for them. They are already dead.
I understand. That is correct. We honor the martyrs. We honor Stephen. We honor the people who died for Christ through the faith, which includes Apostle Paul and Apostle Peter. Many of the apostles died for Christ. Now, this is the thing. When you are a small minority and you have no power, you have to have the courage to even suffer and die for Christ. Whoever denies Christ, he will deny. Whoever confesses Christ before men, him will the Lord confess before his Holy Father and the angels. And so, yes, the time, and I've been a prisoner. I've been a prisoner and I've been tortured and I've been put against a wall for a firing squad and I expect to die right then. And I was willing to do it because I love the Lord and I do not fear death. But there are other times when we have power, when we have responsibilities. And if Christians become a majority like they are in Ethiopia, if Christians become a majority like they are in South Sudan or in Nigeria or Kenya, should they not then organize their armed forces and the communities to defend what's theirs against the Muslims? Because if we Christians can become a majority in a country and not defend it, then the Muslims will just come in and take it. If every Christian becomes a pacifist, it will not make any Muslims a pacifist or communist a pacifist. It's useless for the sheep to pass resolutions in favor of vegetarianism if the wolf remains of a different opinion. We may say, let's all be vegetarians, and all the sheep can vote yes. Bah. But if the wolf doesn't believe in vegetarianism, what good does that do? We Christians may not want war, but the Muslims want war and have declared war. They're attacking our churches and murdering our pastors now. What are we to do? Now, if you're a Christian Egyptian, you're a minority. Only 10% of Egypt are Christians. They're in a vulnerable position. We know this. But we are not a minority in Kenya or South Sudan or Tanzania, are we? Or in South Africa. So why should Christians, when we have the legal right to organize for defense, not do so? That is what I'm saying. Look, the time I have been a missionary in communist Muslim countries where I was taken, handcuffed, chained, shackled, dragged off, waterboarded, tortured, and what could I do except trust God? And he opened prison doors and set the captives free. I'm not afraid of suffering for Christ, but I'm not afraid of fighting against enemies of God either. And so whatever God calls, if I'm to die in battle against Islamic jihadists, or if I'm to die as a martyr for Christ, it is in God's hands, and I'm not afraid of either. I'm not afraid of death, but I will fight if I've got the means to fight. And so this is my conviction. You may not have that conviction. I know some Christians are very convinced they should be pacifists, but I'm challenging you to rethink that. So how can we explain the Crusades to a Muslim when the Muslims have been pumped full of hatred and resentment and a sense of injustice done to them? Well, you must understand that the Muslims started the war. They attacked the Christians using jihad. So the Crusades were only a reaction to jihad. And the moment they bring up the Crusades, you must say, well, if you want to talk about the Crusades, can we talk about the jihad that preceded it? The Crusades were a reaction to 5 centuries of Islamic jihad. Before the First Crusade began, the Christians had already endured 5 centuries, 500 years of Islamic jihad, and now they're complaining about the Crusades. This is bizarre. You don't get that upset over self-defense. And yet they have built up a myth, a whole mythology about the Crusades, so that the Crusades are so evil, and now they as Muslims can say they have been victims. The Muslims love acting as victims. The moment they do a terrorist attack, what is the first thing they consider? That they might be discriminated against for being Muslim. Instead of being concerned for the people who have just been beheaded or blown up or murdered, they're concerned about some Muslims might have their feelings hurt, as people resent the Muslims for all the violence they do. This is ridiculous. So, why, if you know the facts about the Crusades, and I've put in your hands the book, so when you are speaking to people with the Slavery, Terrorism, Islam book, you've got the example, they're the ones who have run most of the slavery in history. They're the ones who are running most of the terrorism in the world today. And now they want us to get upset about the Crusade, which ended 700 years ago. That's a bit bizarre, is it not? So, next question. Yes.
Yes. I've been debating with Muslims, and some of them have some knowledge of verses in the Bible. Of course, their interpretation most of the times are wrong. But I'm saying, what do you think of an indication where Christian leaders at least may have some knowledge of the Quran to be able to counterattack? Because Christians now consider their leaders, Christians, like ignorant, because they don't know the Quran, they can't show the contradictions.
Yes. It is absolutely vital for us to know the Quran well enough to be able to respond to it. There are so many key passages in the Quran that point to Jesus. And so, in fact, there's chapters here on comparing the Quran and the Bible and comparing Muhammad and Jesus. It's no contest when we get into this. So, yes, we should know our enemy. We must know Islam, for sure.